Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we gather around our table here. We are at the studios of KHOI Community Radio here in downtown Ames. We are kind of in the middle of Iowa and middle of the country. And
the belly of the beast.
And that is what we're going to be talking about, beasts in general and bellies. And anyway, thank you for being with us today. Well, we survived a lunar eclipse a couple days ago, about a week and a half ago.
Yeah, it was the blood moon.
Oh, it was absolutely lovely. Seldom do we see something so lovely happening in the evening sky. There wasn't much of a cloudy sky.
No, it was nice, and it was quite late, like midnight-ish, 11 right. o'clock. I took the dog for a walk around the neighborhood at 11 o'clock and bumped into various viewing parties.
It was fun. It was good. I thought we had to have some guests staying with us who had one of these fancy, telescopes that kind of follow the moon. So it was always in view and always in focus.
Oh, my.
It was fancy. It was, anyway, we survived. The moon did come back. I'm happy to report. So the Earth is safe for a while, anyway. So good. It's really nice to get a larger perspective on things every now and then. Well, today we're going to talk about the price of meat. With summer coming, there's people think about, well, grilling and
backyard barbecue.
And grilling and meat. And if you have been to the grocery store recently, you've noticed there's high prices at the grocery store, and meat prices are kind of hitting the roof. World events seem to be the causes of high prices at the grocery store, but people are kind of looking
a quandary about what's causing this high prices. And, of course, the rush to judgment is that it's one political party or the other. Frankly, it's probably both of them.
It's all of us, too, because we do like our meat, and the demand for meat just doesn't seem to go away.
Well, we're going to have a little story about why that is, right?
Why that is, yes. Iowa agriculture, Iowa does corn and soy and meat. We do lots of meat. To kind of start out here, I'd like to read a little bit from newspaper man and writer Mr. Art Cullen. Art Cullen is a publisher and editor of the Storm Lake Times Pilot, a real live newspaper.
Yes, and he's our Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist as well. He's highly regarded. He's not just some crackpot writing a column here. So listen up. He's a good writer.
Yes, he's a good writer. Also,
an insightful writer, too.
He comes to us from a place in Iowa. Storm Lake is a town, and it is in Buena Vista County. Buena Vista, he says, is the beating heart of a protein production complex that's coming under increasing scrutiny and attack for consolidation and industrialization. There's a lot of...
Is it a hog processing plant that's in Storm Lake?
Yes.
Yeah.
But they may do other things.
A big
too.
One. A big one.
But it is a big one. There are a lot of things that happen up there. And there's also a real connection with immigrants that have come to do what we consider our dirty work. The working in meat production facilities.
In the processing plants, yeah.
There's a lot of things to talk about here. Here's something else that Art Cullen says. Iowa leads the world in pork and egg production, and it is in the pack with beef, turkey, and other meat production. Cattle are moving back to the state as wells get drunk dry from perennial drought in the Great Plains. dairy, too, as California burns. Iowa soil is rapidly flowing down the Mississippi River to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico at least 4 times faster than nature can replenish the soils in Iowa. A growing world population demands more from more protein. And he ends this little paragraph by saying, the clock ticks on this game. Lots of stuff to talk
game.
About.
Game
here.
It is. We are being gamed.
Okay, good. Chuck Grassley, our fine senator, and others called for the meatpacking executives into Congress for talks about what happens when 3 or 4 companies control 75% of our beef and pork production. Lots to talk about there. So, joining us today at the Donna Lana kitchen table is Dr. Jan Flora.
Yes, Jan is the Emeritus Professor of Sociology, and that is Rural Sociology, at Iowa State University. He studies rural communities and the lives of Latino farm workers here in Iowa. Jan, welcome to our discussion about meat growing and packing in Iowa. Is he there?
Yeah, but apparently he's not here anymore.
Oh,
Well, we are trying.
All right, we're having some technical difficulties on our Zoom here, so we'll launch into some of this while our trusty engineer Mike finds out how we can talk to Jan.
Oh, he can try now. He wasn't wearing his
head. Are you there, Jan?
I am.
Welcome to our meat processing discussion, meat growing and processing discussion. I've already introduced you.
Okay, I don't have a very good search engine, so I couldn't find the link.
Oh, okay. Well, we have a couple of articles, and I'll just I'll go through them, and Jan can make comments because this is his specialty. The first article, this is something that happened, and we invited Jan back because early in the pandemic, when everybody was realizing that Iowa was very vulnerable to widespread COVID because of what was going on in the meatpacking industry. And Jan was on the show with a young fellow who organizes that sort of thing, and we had an in-depth conversation about the horrific nature of the meatpacking industry. So in the last few weeks, there was I think it was a congressional hearing anyway, where the big meat packers got hauled up before Congress. So I'm going to read from this newspaper article. This is from ProPublica, but this was covered in all the major newspapers. The ProPublica says, the plot to keep meat packing plants open during COVID. So it turns out that, of course, and we talked about this in the show, and we were suspicious of the whole thing, but of course it was worse than we thought. So what happened was, it says, as hundreds of meatpacking workers fell sick from the coronavirus that was spreading through their plants and into their communities, because it didn't just stay in the plants. Of course, the workers went home, gave it to their families, the whole thing. The CEO of Tyson reached out to the head of another major meatpacker, Smithfield, and they were both lamenting, how our workers are getting sick, what should we be doing? And so one of them, CEO of Smithfield named Ken Sullivan, joined somebody named Noel White, who was the Tyson CEO. And the Tyson CEO had a brilliant idea from his perspective, is to call his political allies at the, I think it was the FDA, or was it the USDA, probably, to call them up, USDA, okay, to call them up, and they basically wrote the script where Trump then declared that as an industry, it was an essential industry. This is a World War II thing where the federal government can sort of say an industry is important to national security, and they have to suspend like the rules of healthcare and things. I mean, explain this to us, Jan. Can you? What happened?
They actually invoked the Defense Production Act.
There it is, the defense,
which we've heard a lot about recently with President Biden, and
because of the baby formula.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think what really happened, I did a little diagram, and I can show it to you, but I don't think it'll do any good since we're on radio. and so the actors that are important here, basically in screwing the workers in the meatpacking plants, are the meatpackers themselves, as you indicated, and then the Trump administration, and remember that the Secretary of Agriculture was Sonny Perdue at that time from Georgia,
mm-hmm.
and he's very much in depth with the industrial ag folks. So we did have this proposal that was made by Smithfield and Tyson to have asking President Trump to provide an executive order that would reduce the liability of the meatpacking companies.
Right, when their workers died, it wasn't their fault, right?
If they were sued by their workers, and we actually have several of these suits going on in Iowa right now, and it's unclear how they're going to turn out. But the main thing was that they wrote what essentially was turned into an executive order with the support of USDA and also Mark Meadows, who we've also heard about more recently, who was Trump's chief of staff. And they got Trump to issue this executive order in early May of 2020. And that essentially stopped. At one point, there were 16 meatpacking plants that were out of commission because their workers were not showing up because they were afraid of COVID. And so it didn't prohibit closing down, but it made it very difficult for a company to close down a plant. And so they got the whole system working again. And that was to the detriment of the workers. And they, the companies, one of the things that a number of them did at different points in time was to give bonuses to the workers for having a perfect attendance record. Well, of course, what that did was to encourage them to go to work sick. And so it just made the pandemic even worse.
Well, and the industry leaders, the Mr. Tyson and Mr. Smithfield, and I will note here that Smithfield is at least significantly owned by a Chinese conglomerate. The thing that they used to to scare the Trump administration into or urge them into doing this national what's it called, Jan?
Defense Production Act.
Okay, was that the meat companies threatened that we were not going to have enough meat on the American table. Now, that puts fear into the hearts of all politicians because, you know, we still got to have at least a chicken in every pot. So under the assumption that we were not going to have enough meat if the plants shut down, they went ahead and did this National Production Act enforcement. And lo and behold, even while the companies were threatening that we were going to have shortages of meat in this country, they were exporting meat as well. So obviously there was some not straight talk going on here. And who suffered? Well, it wasn't the meatpacking conglomerates. It was the people of Iowa who had higher COVID
rates.
Yeah,
and it turned out that during the time that all of this, these closings were going on and the executive order was being prepared in April of 2020, it turned out that that month was the highest month for pork exports during the 3 years preceding. And ultimately, essentially what the companies did, and it's rather similar to what happened with the baby food business, is that they raised their prices because they said they had more, they had to pay their workers more and so forth. But in reality, they ended up increasing their net profits by about 500%.
Whoa.
So obviously, that was not the justification that they gave for raising the prices was not correct.
Well, there's been a lot of this, you know, because, of course, all the consumers are concerned. That would be us, right? About our food prices, about our gasoline and energy prices. And then there's all this talk of, oh, well, it is corporate price gouging. Are these guys making out like bandits? Well, this story seems to say that was true. And then, of course, the legislative response is, well, maybe we should do what they're calling windfall taxes. But that's really, I believe, mostly aimed at, like, oil and gas companies. Nobody's talking about the meat industry, right?
No, but there is discussion about breaking up the large meat packing firms. And I don't, you've probably noticed that Senator Grassley is kind of out in the lead on this issue. But, the things that he's proposing is simply to have some transparency in reality. And he really hasn't proposed, actually doing some breakup of the companies, and I think that's where, you know, this gets us a little bit away from it, but it also has to do with food. I think Biden really could have using the baby formula issue as a justification to begin to break up some of these large firms, and that would clearly make it more difficult for them to essentially collude in raising prices when they think that the market will bear it. And usually that's when there's a crisis for the most of the people in our economy.
Well, right now the babies are having the crisis, but there's that old saying that wheels of justice turn slowly, but I might add the wheels of government barely turn at all. We were having this same conversation about breaking up monopoly within the meatpacking industry during the Obama administration, where there were rather well-attended hearings with farmers all over the country, and they were going to try to change what's it called, the packing and stockyards thing, and do some enforcement and things like that. And then, of course, after the listening sessions, they must not have liked what they heard, because nothing happened. And that was, in the Obama administration. Then, of course, the Trump administration, nothing happened and things got worse. And it's hard to be optimistic, you know, when you hear these discussions. I mean, however, the only solutions seem to be lying in the political realm. It's not like consumers can opt their way out of these higher prices. I don't know. There's a new article also from Food and Water Watch. It's called The Economic Cost of Food Monopolies, The Hog Bosses. And what it is talking about is specifically in Iowa, because, of course, we are the largest beneficiaries of this industry. So what they're saying here, and Jan can talk about this, I'm going to read a quote here, is Iowa lost nearly 90% of its hog farms from 1982 to 2017 as rapid factory hog expansions drove out smaller family scale farms. So what this article is about is we supposedly are supposed to have economic benefits from this. Well, you know, yes, we are producing more hogs, but we are doing it. Fewer and fewer farmers are doing this. And it says counties that sold the most hogs and those with the largest farms suffered decline across several economic indicators, including real median household income and total wage jobs. So it turns out that these big factory farms that we have been told are really good for farmers, really good for Iowa, actually are not. They're certainly not good for the environment. That's very obvious. But they're also not producing the economic gains that we were supposed to get. Now, every once in a while, there's some moratorium on building new CAFOs is the sort of the ground entry level for where we can begin to address this in the state of Iowa. And of course, that gets very little traction because of the vested interests. But the factory farm industry depends on the this is a little back history of how we got it. The factory farm industry depends on the overproduction of feed grain like corn and soybeans, yet the grain farmers also experienced significant real price drops between 1982 and 2007, 52 and 39% per bushel, respectively for corn and soybeans. Iowa has also lost more than 40% of its corn and soybean farms as production shifted to larger operations. So we're growing more on less farms for less money for the farmers, making cheaper inputs. The history of this is farmers used to grow pigs, right? And to grow pigs, they had to be able to grow what you feed to pigs. So the size of the pig operation was limited by the land that could be used to feed pigs, you know, because they had to also feed other people too. And as the crop, you know, as we lessened our New Deal farm policies that had encouraged farmers to cut back on production in exchange for price supports. These price supports were kind of the U.S. and government then embraced free trade, aimed to increase domestic production and to use expanding export markets to soak up the excess commodities. In the 1970s, the Agriculture Secretary famously said, this is the plant fence row to fence row, just grow as much as you can. And then that created so much excess grain that it was actually cheaper for the farmers to buy the food for the pigs. And then they could have unlimited amounts of pigs because they didn't have to grow the food themselves. They could just buy it. So as a result of the price supports, we got these huge in CAFOs, right? With the promise of.
I think the other linkage that's really important there, or lack of it, is the pig farmers get separated from their local community. None of the inputs that are provided by the companies, which I don't know what percentage, but I think about 60% of the pigs that are raised in Iowa are raised in a vertically integrated system That is, the farmer doesn't own the hogs.
Like chickens, yeah.
Yeah, it's becoming more and more like the chicken industry. And that just cuts out the local community. So there's a pretty direct relationship between the decline that we've experienced, and it's accelerated recently in the rural communities. And the nature, the structure of the hog operations. So, you know, you get what you pay for, I guess.
Yeah, we have a lot to consider, especially how this affects not just us as consumers, but Iowa farmers. After all, that's part of the makeup of who we are. And if the farmers aren't doing so well economically, something must be wrong. We'll come back and talk more with Jan Flora. This is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. It was a Barn Owl band playing a song called Behind the Haystack. Lots goes on our farms. Yes, it does. We're talking to Jan Flora about meat production. Jan, what has happened to, I assume the meat production is kind of back to normal, but what's happening to all of the people that work in these meat production plants here in Iowa? I mean, there's the farmers that bring the hogs and chickens to the meat processing places, but have conditions improved for people inside? And how does that affect the Latino immigrant population?
I think that in general, the wages have gone up, and the reason they have is because we have a shortage of labor. And part of the shortage of labor goes back to the Trump administration's attempt to really shut down immigration. We noticed that particularly in terms of refugees. You know, we generally had about a million refugees a year coming into the U.S., and he shut that down so that by 2020, I think it was down to about 15,000, I think. Anyhow, it was a huge decrease. And I don't know if I suspect you guys remember when we had the ICE raids of the meatpacking plants back in the 2000s. And in Iowa, and that essentially meant that people who were undocumented were less likely to be able to work in those meatpacking plants. So refugees, and I noticed some of the Afghan refugees are working in meatpacking plants, and they're a much more desirable group from the point of view of the meatpacking owners, because they don't have to worry about their legal status. And but in any case, since we had a reduction in immigration, we ended up with a labor shortage, and the pay rate for the workers has increased. So in that sense, there is an improvement in their situation. The other thing that happened was that once the vaccinations were available, then the meatpacking companies started paying more attention to the health of their workers. And, you know, it's sort of ironic that Tyson was in the lead in doing things that were against the health of the workers and resulted in many more deaths than there should have been. Once we had vaccines, why, they mandated that all of their workers be vaccinated. So that's also contributed to a much lower incidence of COVID among.
Well, that was a simple fix for them because the federal government paid for the vaccines.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, it didn't really cost them.
Didn't cost them anything.
All this kind of comes back to food prices, because the people that work in the plants and people on Main Street and you and I, we all pay food prices. And there's winners and losers. The prices go up, but it doesn't seem often that the money goes back to the farmers and the producers of the product. I learned some word definitions here. Monopoly, and we're talking about concentration of wealth in meat processors who own so much of the meat processing industry. There's monopoly is one thing. That's what they can charge for what they sell. And if there's no competition, they can raise the prices. Or they can tell us that, well, they have to raise the prices. But there's also another word, monopsony. Monopsony. And that is kind of another side of it. It's the power of buying. When you are such a big monopoly, you have the power to set the prices that you give to the farmer. So a lot of people aren't aware that if farmers sell their cattle, hogs, chickens to these big companies, they really have very little, if no, say as to what they are going to get.
Because there's only one place to sell
their
grains or their pigs or their chickens. So a lot of these problems really are going to have to be fixed on a government level. And, there's not been willingness in either party to confront the lobbying of the, and this is true not certainly just in the food industry, it's kind of everywhere. Like you talked about, Jan, about of what Grassley is saying, because he's up for election this year. So he, like all good politicians, knows that, the people are unhappy to be paying certainly more for their food costs. This is a big deal. So he's talking about, we got to do something about it. But what he's talking about, and you explained this, is it's not enough. It's not going to change things. What could change things?
So I wanted to back up and take a kind of a 30,000 foot view of this.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that we need to also think about inflation, because the two sectors that are showing the greatest amount of inflation that affect consumers are gas prices at the pump,
mm-hmm,
and food prices.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those, well, in the case of food prices, an awful lot of the increase in costs has to do with the supply chains. In the meat packing or in the meat growing business, it has a lot to do with the cost of the inputs, most of which are domestic.
Inputs, as in what they feed the animals.
What they're feeding their animals.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of the baby food crisis, it has to do with some ingredients which are sourced outside the U.S., and as well as the extreme concentration. They're really, rather than four or five baby food companies controlling 90%, it's like two or maybe three that control that proportion in the baby food business. And so they're very much dependent on their supply chains, and that's why we're now bringing baby food in by plane from Europe and other places. So all of this contributes to the increase in inflation. And I think, you know, one of the things that I find just incredible is that the Biden administration gets a bad rap for the inflation that's going on. But in fact, since it has to do with those supply chains, it has an awful lot to do with the neoliberal trade model. And, you know, we can get into foreign policy as well, why we are attacking China to the degree that we are, when we depend so much on them for those, for the cheap inputs that we get for a lot of our products. So everything seems to be highly interrelated, but I don't think that we can really expect the meatpacking industry to be the first one that goes under the Packing and Stockyards Act. See, we have all of the legal opportunities to begin to break up some of these large.
Yes, we have the laws already on the books.
Yeah, they're already in place. It's just a matter of having the will to deal with them. So that's I think that's where that's one of the things we have to look at. In addition to changing the taxation structure so that the wealthy don't make such huge quantities of money. And I am encouraged by the fact that labor unions are strengthening now. And I don't know how far that will go, but I think it's certainly it's probably one of the few bright spots that we see in our economy.
Well, and do you think that's because of the labor shortage?
I think it's partly because of the labor shortage, and it's partly because of the way the workers, frontline workers, were treated during COVID. And they just don't have any great loyalty to these companies that turned their backs on them during the pandemic.
Well, how do you think, as a country, we can sort of get the will to take on some of this antitrust legislation, which, since we don't have to ask Congress to pass the laws are already there. So what's stopping us from getting a better, a better public structure for some of these business practices?
Well, the short answer for that is Joe Manchin.
Yes, he is an example of some of these things, right?
But actually, that's not true in this, strictly true in this case, because you really don't need Congress to act. You need the president to act.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I didn't finish one of my thoughts, which was that Biden has done something that is really remarkable. Because if you go back to the Great Recession, which occurred in 2007 to 2009, basically it took from 2009 until 2019, or 20, really, until COVID came on the horizon, for us to get back to where we were before the Great Recession. And that was because Obama bailed out the banks, which is okay, but he didn't bail out the homeowners. And I think actually some of the stimulus packages actually started under Trump, in response to the COVID recession. But Biden really saw that what we had to do, and we are now back, what is it, just a little over 2 years past the beginning of the COVID recession, and we're more or less back to where we were before as a nation. Iowa is behind, but the nation as a whole is really back economically to where it was at the beginning of 2020.
Why do you think Iowa is behind?
That's a whole nother story, and that includes one of the other circles of players in the meatpacking area, and that has to do with our governor and the Iowa Department of Public Health and another one is Iowa OSHA. So basically what happened in the early part of the COVID pandemic was that the governor sort of worked hand in glove with the meatpacking folks and the Trump administration in preventing us from taking action to save the lives of the people who worked in the meatpacking plants. And so here's sort of how it worked. The meatpacking companies said, well, the number of cases of COVID in our plants is proprietary information.
Ooh.
Now, in fact, that wasn't true because the governor could have, in an emergency, made sure that we got testing in those plants. And I guess the best example that I can think of was in the Perry plant, which is a Tyson plant. And by the time, let me back up just one step. The Iowa Department of Public Health said that an outbreak in the meatpacking companies had to be at least 10% of the people either being infected or engaging in absenteeism. So you had to have 10% of your labor force that was essentially unable to work because of COVID. Then you declared an outbreak. But the problem was that there was no way of knowing when you reached that point. A complaint was made, I think, by the union at the Perry plant that people were getting infected and were dying. And so they lodged a formal complaint to Iowa OSHA. And it's, unlike in many other states, it's independent of the U.S. OSHA, but it also has to follow U.S. OSHA rules. And it took 17 days for them for it to get back to they're actually making a decision. The subcommittee report that we're talking about lays out what actually happened. And some of the internal documents of Iowa OSHA indicate that we're not going to send our inspectors to inspect that plant because it's too dangerous. There's too much COVID there. And so they ended up, since they couldn't inspect it, they ended up giving them a bill of health. And ultimately, the situation got so bad that the governor pushed them to do some testing. And it turned out that 58% of the people already who worked there already had COVID. So you can see that state government didn't help out any. In fact, they worked to, in the end, increase the number of people who got COVID and the number of people who died in the meatpacking plants. And the subcommittee report, what they did, they simply asked the companies how many people were infected by COVID and how many died. And since we didn't have any official records, it turned out to be about three times as many as had been noted from the, essentially from the press.
Ooh.
That was one of the big take-home points of this report that was done by this subcommittee on the coronavirus crisis. And so something like, rather than having 88 people die, which was what we knew publicly from COVID in the meatpacking plants, it was something like 287 or something like that. So it was three times.
Okay, so it took 2 years and a congressional hearing to get just an accurate analysis with numbers, right?
And that's probably an underestimate because the companies probably didn't know who all got infected, and there were probably some folks who quit their jobs and died later that they didn't find out about.
Well, or their maybe they, family members
or
who
their
died.
Obituaries did not show that they had contracted COVID and that was the cause of death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's a complicated problem, and we don't want to ruin the backyard barbecue, but I don't know.
Well, how we get our food, how we get our grain, meat, fruit, vegetables, there's got to be different ways for doing this, putting people's lives on the line just so we can have our backyard barbecue seems a bit extreme here.
Well, there are a few recommended local options, and that is to buy your meat locally directly from the farmer. Now that usually a farmer that is direct marketing is also using small local lockers, of which we have, fortunately, a slightly growing number here in the state of Iowa. And at these local lockers, like the one in Story City, where they don't do chickens there, they do beef and pork and venison, I guess. You can go in and see what's happening there. It's the best possible thing you can do, and of course you're going to pay a little more, is you can go to the farmer's market. Is a good place to find local meat products. There, I think Practical Farmers of Iowa has a listing of farmers that sell direct to consumer. There's also the Des Moines Farmers Market and what's the co-op? The Iowa Food Co-op in Des Moines. There are lots of places in Iowa where farmers are actually growing their own cows and pigs, and you can buy directly from them, and it's usually pretty tasty stuff.
And leaving the large producers out of the loop. It's small now, but it is growing. Jan, do you have any final words of hope for the future here. What do we have about World Food Supplies and Iowa Food Supplies?
Well, I just wanted to add to what Donna said. Nick Wallace has organized something called 99 Counties, in which he's trying to organize basically a food hub that would initially sell to folks in Chicago, but hopefully would also result in sales to local folks in Iowa.
Yeah, Nick does have his own distribution system. You can go on his website, and once a month he has his refrigerated truck come to Ames, so I know he's going other places as well. That's an excellent suggestion, and Nick is so committed to this idea of local meat that he's been doing it, that he's working to expand it for other farmers. That's what Jan's talking about, the 99 counties of Iowa.
Yes.
I think there's sort of an advantage and a disadvantage, a good and bad side of it, that we have an Iowan as our Secretary of Agriculture in the U.S. And one of the things that I was disappointed about Bill Sack was that he seems to be promoting the development of an additional meatpacking plant in somewhere near Council Bluffs. And I think that's the wrong way to go. I think what we really need to do, and what one of the lessons from the COVID pandemic is, we really need to strengthen those local locker plants so that the next time COVID comes around, or some successor to COVID, which there will be, we're much more prepared to deal with what should be the shutdown of those large companies, because they're toxic for their workers. And let's build that local food system and get rid of the long supply chains that it
smaller
represents.
Local lockers.
Good.
Exactly.
Good. Well, thank you for being with us, and thank you for sharing that. We've been talking to Dr. Jan Flora about the price of pork and other things, how meat is produced here in Iowa. Thank you for being with us today, Jan.
You bet.
Oh, you've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've got a message here from Mike Murphy, our station manager, about an upcoming event that has to do with this fine radio station.
And this is a fine radio station, isn't it? KHOI, only on the air because of listeners who continue to support it, to a wonderfully supportive community that supports us so we can support the community. Well, there's a concert at Stevens Auditorium on Thursday night, A.V. Grouse Band, along with Matt Woods. And if you go to khoifm.org to purchase your tickets that way, a good portion of the proceeds goes to KHOI. And we look to these things. That's how to make money, to keep ourselves on the air. So it's a great way to celebrate these both Iowa artists, great way to celebrate Iowa music and community radio. There's also a live streaming option. You can stream from the comfort of your own home and take avail yourself of this concert and still support community radio.
Thanks, Mike. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been talking about meatpacking industry here in Iowa. A lot of the immigrant workers come from the Latin America, and here's a tune about a place in Costa Rica. The tune is called The Cloud Forest, written by Mike Bell from the Barnau Band. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.